supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Common Space. Listen, if there's one historically consistent black male presence in American society, it's men of faith. Our pastors, preachers, reverends, bishops, apostles, and so on. And not only are they men of faith, they are also men of action. I'm Jamie J, here in the studio with Elizabeth Perez Luna of WHYY. And this is Common Space, a collaboration between WHYY and First Person Arts. Common Space is a place where true personal stories speak to the pressing issues of our time. Today, we're looking at black men of the church and how their leadership continues to shape our communities and country. A common thread runs through all chapters of African American history since the times of slavery. That thread is a life force that's been channeled through the black church. And the head of the black church is its leader, often a man, whose function is to minister to the spirit of the people. It's a role that ranges from the daily spiritual and practical obligations of a religious leader to the more visible, all-encompassing job of advocating for social justice and equality.
So, Jamie, now that we did the introduction, and this is a podcast, let's talk, because I know that you grew up in the church, that your family was very religious. So what was the interaction with your family, the church, the pastors, or the reverends? Tell me about the men of the church where you grew up, and tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I would say that I have had a varied experience with the black church, and it's all positive. The little town I grew up in is called Morton, and my ancestors actually were some of the founding members of the First Baptist Church of Morton, where our pastor, Reverend Parsons, was a very impassioned preacher. So much so that my first memory of going to church was I would lean over to my grandmother and whisper, "Why is he yelling at me? What did I do wrong?" Because he was so energetic and passionate at the pulpit. And my grandmother, of course, being, you know, an ancestor of founding members of the church, she had a certain, you know, role to play when she went into church. So, of course, you know, me whispering to her, why is he yelling at me, Granny? I don't understand. What did I do wrong? You know, and the congregation was very reserved, you know, whereas when I later, you know, grew up and went to a African Methodist Episcopal church in the same town, you know, it was okay. You know, people were dancing in the aisles, and that was a totally new experience. And, oh, my gosh, the Pentecostal church that I, you know, attend, you know, not as often as I should, but, I mean, there's full-on fainting in the church services and shouting and singing. And also, you know, the service has changed a lot. You know, there is a ritual to the service, you know, and that is one thing I deeply love about religion. You know, you have to affirm certain things as part of the ritual of the service. But, you know, in the last 20 years, the traditional gospel music and spirituals has changed to something that's more pop and more accessible, even influenced by hip hop. There are now ministries of dance. My Pentecostal church in Delaware actually has a mime that performs. I mean, this was unheard of when I was a youngster in church. I mean, there was a very formal service, very formal rituals, and, you know, you left refreshed and inspired. You go into the church to lay down your burdens. You know, we're talking, you know, in the 70s, it was much more reserved. And then when I got a little bit older, I wanted to sing in the church choir at the other church in Morton, which was Shorter AME Church. Now, Shorter had a reverend who was also as impassioned, but the congregation at Shorter was much more passionate back. So at Shorter, you had, you know, very vibrant praise, which I love that you could say yes and, you know, pat your feet at Shorter AME Church. And that was wonderful. As I've grown up and lived in city to city and gone different places, I've also experienced the Pentecostal church, which I go to in Delaware occasionally. Now, I need to say that I don't go like I should, but God is with me every day. And in the Pentecostal church, there's Bishop Apostle Weeks, and he is the king or the head of the that church. And at New Destiny Fellowship, which is the name of the church, Apostle Weeks is very theatrical. Once he brought out a coffin in the middle of service and opened it up and invited us to place our fears and our burdens, you know, write them on paper and put them into the coffin. What an exciting, exciting service. So I've had quite a few experiences. Now, what you need to know is what church you belong to is important. And how often you go is important. You know, so people in the black community, in the black faith community, will say to you, who's your bishop? Who's your pastor? Who's your preacher? And that is very important. So you need to be able to respond with that. And if you respond, as I too often do, by saying, sometimes I go here and sometimes go there, you will be encouraged to find a home, find a church home, because of its importance.
So what you're saying is, if you have to declare who your bishop is, it means that every church has a specific leader who has all the difficult and not so difficult functions of being a head of the church. So the way I see it is that these leaders are at the center of everyday life, in hard times and in easy times. And their function is not just to minister, like you said, to the spirit of the people, but also being keenly aware of the welfare of the community. So it's the spiritual and the practical.
Yeah, and it's a role that ranges from the daily and practical obligations of a religious leader to more visible, all-encompassing job of advocating for social justice and equality.
Why Jesus called a man a fool. I want to share with you a dramatic little story from the gospel as recorded by St. Luke. It is the story of a man who, by all standards of measurement, would be considered a highly successful man. And yet Jesus called him a fool.
And each one of these religious leaders have their own unique personality and preaching style. For example, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in that 1967 sermon we just heard, Why Jesus Called a Man a Fool. Now listen to a different style, Reverend and Congressman Adam Clayton Powell preaching in 1957.
This is the creative ferment that made America the land of the free and the home of the brave, but it's gone. This was the ferment that sent farmers, rude farmers, if you please, illiterates, but nevertheless sensitive to God, to stand at the arching bridges of Lexington, Concord, and fire shots that echoed around the world. These farmers fired shots that destroyed the paid mercenaries, the Hessians of the British Empire, to give America its freedom. This was the creative ferment that gave inspiration to the black man, who was the first man, black or white, in the history of our republic to die for the freedom of our nation. He was Crispus Attucks from Barbados. Of course, we don't read about them in our history books because they won't write about them. But in Boston Commons, in an obscure corner, there is a monument to his memory. Oh God, send us prophets and preachers today to restore the creative ferment of American excellence. Give us what our forefathers had. Return to us the sense of justice and the sensitivity of freedom. When this nation was once torn between North and South, James Russell Lowell wrote, "When a blow is struck for freedom, the echoes across the broad earth's surging breast, a thrill of joy prophetic that trembles on from east to west, and the slave, wherever he cowers, feels his soul within him climb."
These are powerful voices that at times soothe the soul and at other times motivated followers to take action. Being a black man in America who is also a man of faith brings with it unique tests and challenges. So we invited Reverend Steve Lawrence of Philadelphia's White Rock Baptist Church to share some insights about his journey to the ministry. He remembers growing up in the North Philadelphia neighborhood where his church is.
I think a lot about my own father and the men in the church as just positive, not just models, but really encouragers along one path instead of another path. When I was growing up in junior high school, it was the days of gang warfare in Philadelphia. So you got out of school and you went home quickly, or you got caught up in something you didn't want to get caught up in. I can remember clearly, again, I was at Sayre when it was a junior high school, and I weighed 98 pounds or something, and I'm getting... sometimes I'm eating my lunch, and sometimes somebody else is eating my lunch. Literally, there was a guy who used to meet me at my locker almost every day to ask for money. And so I'm getting bullied, and I'm not dealing well with it. And the thing that got me out of there was the opportunity to go to Central, just to get out of that neighborhood. But it was my dad who was just this example of, you work hard, you work diligently, and it will work out for your benefit. My dad worked for Pennsylvania Railroad, and it would be snowing hard, and the phone would ring, and he had to get up and go out and clear a track so that somebody else could get to work or get to Pittsburgh or whatever. And I never heard him complain about it. He just did it. He provided for us, even though it cost him so much. So that has just always been a part of me. I've never convinced myself that there's not going to be a cost connected with doing ministry. I've always seen the church as a place where I chose to spend my life. The way you spend something, you eke it out. It's going to take something from you because it's that important. And there were men in the church, other deacons, Sunday school teachers, who I guess they saw gifts in me and they encouraged me. They made sure I spent time in that environment and not in another environment. At our church in the 70s, we had a roller skating program on Fridays. Our choir that I was in became the group that sponsored this roller skating. And it attracted a whole group of people, some nice people and some other kind of people. I can remember on one occasion we were walking to get some potato chips or something from the church. It was just me and two other friends, guys and girls. And another group of people are coming down the street toward us. So your life almost slows down, doesn't it? What are we going to do about this situation? We come toward them and they ask the question you always ask, you know, where are you from? Now, as soon as you mention a street name, it's either going to be on or not, depending on where they're from. And I remember my friend just yelled out, "Look at us. We're not from nowhere, man. We're just from the church."
Lawrence and Reverend Wallace Smith of the powerful Shiloh Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., President Obama's church, were the co-founders in 2009 of an organization called NUCOR, or New Conversation on Race and Ethnicity. It's a gathering place for interfaith dialogue created at Eastern University Palmer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania. Now, the school was headed by Wallace at that time, and he's built a national reputation for strong sermons about race relations. Here's one of his sermons delivered in 2010.
this nation is still facing a huge challenge. And we're facing it because when you look at what's going on, it may not be Jim Crow anymore. Now Jim Crow wears blue pinstripes, goes to the law school and carries fancy briefs and cases. And now Jim Crow has become James Crow Esquire. And he doesn't have to wear white robes anymore, because now he can wear the protective cover of talk radio, or can get a regular news program on Fox. Doesn't have to wear his white garments anymore. In fact, I said to my church...
You know, Jamie, Reverend Wallace is a quiet, reserved man. But when he is in the pulpit, when he is giving his sermon, when he's talking to people about what he believes is important for the black community, he's not that quiet, as you just heard. But he's acutely aware of the historic importance and responsibility of the black church. And he told me that a few years ago.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The African American church has been the pillar of the black community and is not just for people who are members of the church, but it is all black churches, and in many ways are anchors of the community. I mean, they deliver social services, counseling, economic development. That just is routine amongst African American churches, whether Baptist or African American Methodist Episcopal or other denominations. And it is, I think the way to understand it is that the black church, the church has become the village. It's the place where African-American people gather. It is where we keep our stories of our past before our children. And it's after people leave work, in many cases, it's to the church that they migrate for whatever meetings and social affairs and anything you can imagine. And the church has really filled that concept of a village.
So then what really happened is not only was each church unique, drawing a unique, distinct congregation, mm-hmm. but each of these churches responded to social justice and equality issues in their own unique way.
That's right. And, you know, a case in point would be in a conversation I had a few years ago with music entrepreneur Ira Tucker Jr. He remembers how in the late 60s, two churches in North Philadelphia, alongside Broad Street near Temple University, reflected different approaches to social and political activism at a time of deep turmoil, what the press called the riots. Here he is, and he's talking about the two principal churches in that area.
Reverend Graves' church, his church was more for the older people.
He's talking about Pastor William Gray III, who became a congressman, a powerful one, in 1979.
So the people who lived in Yorktown and, say, our parents, they would gravitate to Reverend Gray's church. Now, Church of the Advocate was where the militants went. And that's where the Black Panthers would go. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and all of those folks would be at the Church of the Advocate. But that's where we would discuss things and to talk about how we were going to protest this and do that. And those two churches were prime for what went on in the 60s. Bright Hope had a lot of power because they had people who had money in the church. The Church of the Advocate was there for the neighborhood, and they advocated. I mean, that was it. And it worked out real good for us.
You know, Elizabeth, part of being a church leader is figuring out how to attract young followers who will continue the relevant work. And there's a lot of competition for the attention of young people today, divided between media, social media, sports, and entertainment.
There's also a lot of competition for financing a church, and that's present in every church, small or large. I spoke with Pastor Alan Waller, who saw an answer in the prosperity gospel model with his megachurch, Enon Tabernacle Baptist, and it is a megachurch with a strong emphasis on young people.
It's an interesting study in the growth of the megachurch and prosperity gospel. One of the challenges, and we've tried to address that, a generation of us, we believed our old pastor who said, you know, he who learns nothing in his teens, knows nothing in his 20s, does nothing in his 30s, has nothing in his 40s. Go to school, go to school, go to school, excel, excel, excel. So we believed it. It's 1982. We graduated from high school. We all went to college. We went to Morehouse. I went to Ohio University. They told us, and you know, there was the boom. It was happening. We graduated from college. We made money. We came back to the old church, and now, you know, we got a little money. We got our first car, and back then you're making $50,000-$60,000, and you're feeling good about yourself, only to hear a bunch of sermons from the old pastor that loved us about money doesn't make you. It doesn't really matter. All you need is Jesus. I'm like, dude, what'd you do? You told us to go get this. Now every Sunday we're made to feel bad about success. And quietly there's this suspicion in minority communities about success. So, all right, you're going to make me feel bad about my car and my new job? I'm out. So they ran. In my generation, we ran, and we ran out, and then we ran into Bishop. And Bishop said, the Lord blessed you. The Lord will give you more if you give some of what you gave back to him. And money is good, and it is a sign of his blessings. And then our whole generation said, you know what, this feels better than that. This feels better than old pastor. At least here, they're telling me Jesus has something to do with this. And I feel better about it. Now, I'm not saying I accept all of the claims of the prosperity gospel, but it then started to move, and we started running out to these large churches where I can just come get mine, get my praise on, give back what I have, my 10%, my tithe, double down on it, and get the Lord to bless me with some more, and all of it's good. And so we ran after this. What God has for me is for me. I'm going to get mine. Give me my blessing. God's got a man for me. God's got a woman for me. God's got more, more, more. Get ready, get ready, get ready. And then we stopped thinking about the other.
I've had the privilege of hearing Reverend Waller preach, and he is an amazing man. And like many pastors before him, he comes from a very religious household and a father who himself was a reverend. In his family, it was given that church was at the center of everyday life. And being a pastor is not for the faint of heart. Reverend Lawrence told us that the demands never stop because that's the job. It's also part of his sense of religious and social responsibility to create a safe and welcoming environment, particularly for young men in search of guidance.
I think one of the challenges that we've taken on is a real keen responsibility for the generation that's coming behind us. We're very much aware that when we look at our lives and theirs, it feels like they are under so much more pressure than we were, even though at the time I'm growing up during gang war, it seems like it's a much more fertile minefield now than then, and that they need not just examples, but they need concrete places to be and concrete words to say and concrete disciplines for themselves. So at our church, there's a group within our church called the Committed Men. And it really got started around the same time as the Million Man March in D.C., though I really think the energy was in the air even before that event happened. And it was the men of the church who decided that they were going to be in relationship with the younger people in the church with little things. We'd have a breakfast on Saturday, eat pancakes, and just talk. We'd have a physician come in and talk about health, or we'd have someone come in and talk about job opportunities. But it really was just about connecting with these young men conversationally, letting them know that here are some people who are here for you. And that was my experience growing up in the church. There were men who, they did their jobs. They trusted us to learn and to do what they were telling us to do. They let us experience them at an intimate level. They were people we could talk to about whatever was going on.
So what's the number one issue with black men today in your congregation, in your community?
Wow. I think it is still trying to define what it means to be a man, what it means to be a black man in this society. Is it tied up with your sexuality and your ability to bring children into the world, whether that's fathering or not? Is it tied up with your ability to work? Boy, sometimes work is about what you have to do, and work is about what you can do, what you're gifted to do. Sometimes work is about this is skirting the limits of what's legal or not legal, but people have to eat, and how do I find myself in that world? And then do I find myself in a place of worship on Sunday with some things that happened this week that I'm not, that are kind of on the edges, or do I just stop going to that place because the life I find myself in, I can't reconcile with that world?
Can you think of any particular example of this that you can talk about?
In generality, I can talk about there are times you have to go to the court system for whatever the offense might be and represent a person or be a person of character for someone who's gotten into trouble with the system in some way or shape or form. And sometimes, I don't really know how that presence is even perceived by the system, but I know that the person and the family appreciate the presence. We were thinking earlier about what's the impact of being a clergy person in the black community. I can't explain why it is this way, but in a lot of ways, over time, black clergy have inherited this mantle of being the presence whom people find comfort in.
So being a pastor means long days that never seem to end. Going from the courthouse to the hospital, prayer meeting to Bible study. And in the midst of all that, finding quiet time to prepare for the pulpit. And let's not forget choir rehearsal. Quote ourselves, being a black man is a full-time job. Being a church leader and a black man must be equivalent to two full-time jobs. And there are many, many black male church leaders. You may not recognize them if they're not wearing their collar or garb, but you never know. The next black man you see may be the leader of a black church. That's it for this Common Space podcast. I'm Jamie J, here with my dear friend Elizabeth Perez Luna, and Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage.
I've come too far from where I start. This is what she said. Nobody told me that the road would be. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave.